one become white? A little bleach might do the trick. Will I bleach my asshole? Does that count?
I don't know.
Wanna see? Duh. Bye.
Techies, take the mission. Techies, gentrify me, gentrify me, gentrify me, gentrify my love.
I have background in prenatal techniques and some anatomy around the pelvic floor that I've learned through Living Now Yoga. And then in terms of all the other things I offer, I started People of Color and Allies yoga series to honor inclusivity and diversity. I lead free yoga for all in the Battery in New York City. Landmark Park downtown, and we just finished our sixth year, or we have two more weeks to finish that out. And I really aim that at democratizing yoga offerings. It's free and it's accessible for all. You can come, you can sit, you can practice if you want. I lead retreats with topics covering asana workshops, those trauma-informed practices I mentioned, and pelvic floor anatomy. And I also created a ABCD Yogi, which is an international community that supports any born conscientious Desi yogi, which means a person of South Asian descent, to reclaim the yoga and mindfulness space by sharing their personal stories and practices with the whole world. And then I was featured on this year's 19 Women of Color to Watch in the Yoga World list. And on top of that, so on top of the podcast work that Jaisal and I do, and on top of ABCD Yogi, I also offer group vinyasa and restorative yoga classes at Humming Puppy. And I offer private yoga, and occasionally I offer level one and two Reiki. I also volunteer with the Lineage Project in a finance and operations capacity. So that's me in a big nutshell.
Jaisal here. I have been teaching yoga since 2010. And like Dajal, I've done lots of trainings in this world, everything from Raja Yoga in India, Vinyasa Yoga in New York, prenatal. I've done meditation courses. I've done, including a Vipassana training, the whole gamut, and tons of anatomy and mobility and all of those types of things. And so my teaching really focuses on making yoga accessible and empowering to the students that I work with, and supporting practical functional movement and lasting change. Most of my teaching centers on private yoga teaching, but I also teach one group class at the moment at a residential gym. And then I teach on staff at a couple of trainings. I've taught in the past anatomy and biomechanics. I also teach the asana punk, the portion of a prenatal training, the Mahamama prenatal training. And through that program, I also offer free and low cost classes through their alumni program. I also teach at, or I'm guest teaching rather, with Prema Yoga Institute's therapeutic training. I volunteer with World Spine Care Yoga Project, and I am the co-creator of the 19 Women of Color to Watch in the Yoga World in 2019. So that's me in a nutshell.
Wow, amazing. Yeah. So what got you guys together to decide to make this podcast, Yoga is Dead?
Angel here. I'll just tell you a little bit about our story. When we met back in 2015 at a specialized teacher training. And like, it was at that training that we formed our relationship, which started as friends and colleagues, but then became like a support system. And we became each other's sounding boards because of these experiences we were going through together in that first teacher training, where we experienced a little bit of silencing and negativity around the knowledge that we brought to the table, being Indian American women and yoga teachers who had trained in India. That wasn't received very well in that training. And we share a lot about that in our episode one called White Women Killed Yoga. And it was at that point that we realized that what we were feeling personally, of feeling isolated and frustrated and a lot of times even angry, it wasn't unique to just me as a person. It was, we both shared those feelings. So going through that helped us to realize, like, this is a common theme potentially for people. So fast forward to 2019, about 4 years later, after we'd stayed friends and like really continued supporting each other through the journey of teaching and navigating the yoga industry, we came up with the idea for a podcast. So we got to a point where we needed an outlet for all of our stories outside of just speaking and supporting one another. And I just want to say, like, about the podcast, and you had asked us why we think it takes up space in a different way. People have mentioned, and we know, that our podcast is a political sounding board, because we take a look at the yoga industry as opposed to the teachings of yoga. So throughout the process of making this podcast, I just want to say that we felt really vulnerable and insecure about sharing so much personal stuff, but we needed to share a message that felt authentic to our real life yoga experiences, and not just a quote, think positive and everything will be okay, philosophy podcast. And then we didn't really want to start with another interview style podcast, because we knew that we were the ones that had the experiences and the stories to tell. So we didn't want to dilute that message right off the bat. And we also recognize that we represent kind of a unique demographic within the Western wellness world, because we are women of color, and because we are Indian American women, or Desi women teaching yoga. And then I realized really personally that I have been so hungry for more representation of Desi people in yoga, which is partly why I started that ABCD Yogi community. And it was surprising to realize, like, we didn't need to wait for anyone else to take up that space. We had enough interest, ideas, and offerings to take up that space. And that's what got us to really June, when we launched our first episode.
Yeah, and I'm really happy that you did take up that space. I feel like I've been waiting for this podcast for so long, like, as a concept. So I'm really glad you guys made that move. You mentioned it was vulnerable to create this podcast. You do delve into a lot of themes, Can you talk about how you go about choosing these themes for the episodes, and how you go about tackling these topics, because they're really vast and big and systemic. So can you tell us a bit about that process?
Sure. We chose the themes after a lot of deliberation. So the process was that we started this podcast process like over 2 years ago at this point, and we sort of went through an iteration of it for, you know, about a year. We probably didn't work on it as seriously as we do now, but over that year, we were kind of like thinking about all the things we want to talk about, mainly revolving around our personal stories. And then after that first year, we sort of went back to the drawing board and said, you know, we don't think this is compelling enough as is. So let's reorganize it. And that really helped us to focus in on, like, what do we want to do? We want to point out some of the things that are really going wrong in this industry. And that's why these things have happened to us. And then from that point, start to give action items. So far we've released 4 episodes, and in the way we have organized them, it's the same method. We suss out what the major touchstones are for each of the episodes. We use our personal stories and our research to highlight the points we want to make. And then we know we're speaking to 3 different audiences: the yoga student, the yoga teacher, and the yoga business owner. And so we end the episodes with action items with each of those audiences in mind.
In your last podcast, for example, the theme about vinyasa, at times even you both come at it with different kind of perspectives or values, or not values, but different, I guess, takes on it. So how do you kind of bridge that when you guys have different takes around it?
This is a great question. I think what actually we didn't tell you is that when we first started this podcast idea, Tejal and I had completely different viewpoints on so many different topics. So even though we have such a similar background, we had similar experiences, we were both feeling like frustrated by the industry, we didn't always arrive at the same conclusion. And so Tejal really thought that that was the interesting thing, that we actually were so different in our ideas and thoughts around what was going on, even though we were so similar in where we were coming from. And so she's like, oh, this would be really interesting for people to listen to, like, these different perspectives. And how do you reconcile that? And what ended up happening is, throughout the process of making the podcast, we found that the more we talked about it, the more we broke down what was really happening, used research, used like information already out there to understand the world a little bit better, like the wellness space especially a little bit better, we ended up really coming to more and more similar thoughts and conclusions. So even though, like, we may have different personal attachments to something, like in this case, like the vinyasa episode, Tejal has a more of a love for vinyasa than I do. But at the same time, she recognizes, like, from the teacher seat, right, we need to view it not just as like our own personal attachment, but what do we want our students to get out of it? And so, like, when you think of it, like, from these different lenses, you actually do come to more of an understanding. Like, yes, even though in your own personal practice, you may value something else, when you're a teacher, what's your responsibility to the people in the room? And that's going to be different. And that's going to be different when you're the business owner, too.
When you were talking about themes, you mentioned you end episodes with action items. That's something that I think is really cool that you incorporate into the kind of the process of the episode. Why was it important for you to put in action items in these episodes?
I'll take that. This is Tejal. It was kind of what Jason was saying. When we started to suss out how we were going to deliver this information, we realized we could take the angle of just being personal about it and going through the timeline of events and what we experienced. And that's fine. That's great information. It's more like you're catching up with a friend over a cup of cha or just like hanging out. But in terms of delivering a message to such a broad community and a potentially global community, we didn't want it to end there. We wanted people to relate to personal stories through whatever lens they were looking at it from. And then also say, yeah, I understand what you're saying and I get why there's an issue. What do we do? And we wanted to be able to answer that question, saying, here's what we can do. And here's a whole plethora of information to back that up. and then ways to move forward so we can affect positive change. Because we realized the only reason we were putting ourselves out there in this vulnerable way is so that we could affect change, and that we wanted to deliver the tools to guide people there.
In the podcast, talk a lot about accessibility, financial accessibility, so many things. How do you incorporate those values into the making and production of the podcast itself?
We've been pretty intentional, I would say. And then we've also been able to review where we kind of made missteps and mistakes to incorporate more accessibility and more of our thoughts into action for the podcast. I've heard this phrase a lot, where your energy, like focus on where your energy and dollars can go to create change. And we wanted to kind of take the same approach. So in creating our concept, and one of the ways we did that was by supporting women and women of color and people of color in making our podcast. So just the logistical aspects of it. Our design is done by someone who lives in Pakistan. Our music was done by a neighbor of mine who is Indian. Our podcast editor is a student of mine, a woman musician. And when we've decided to partner with people externally, we've made an effort to partner with organizations and offer our workshops with organizations that align on our mission of accessibility, inclusivity, and diversity. So we've done that by our workshops being low cost options with sliding scale. We've offered discounts to our products. We have offered giveaways to see us at our workshop. And our podcast itself is free and accessible to anyone who can find it. And then throughout the process, people ask, do you have transcripts of what you've been doing? I can't hear them. So do you have a way for me to read them? And so we then started working on transcriptions of our podcast. And we have a group of volunteers that helps us transcribe and proofread the transcriptions. And that's also free in a readable format, PDF, and you can get it from our shop. The other thing that was really, really an interesting point of launching this podcast and then it being successful is how much people want to connect to us and share their stories and also give feedback and sometimes offer messaging and questions to us that doesn't feel very safe. So we've taken this approach where we respond to almost every single comment, direct message, and like Facebook message that we receive that doesn't feel threatening and isn't just an obviously hateful message. So we try to foster more communication through that. And outside of speaking directly with us, which sometimes we have limited time, I mean, more and more we have limited time, we've created a Facebook group directly through our Yoga is Dead Facebook page that is fostering even more conversation and community and even creating connections locally with people. And then we keep talking about these tips and these ways to move forward. I feel like continuing education is just another way of doing your yoga. You're constantly in inquiry about the things we're talking about and ways to do better in whatever socio-political environment you're in. And so we offer tips at the end of our episodes for the yoga teachers, students, and the yoga business owners on how to move forward with positive change. And we publish that comprehensive and free resource guide on our website so you can continue your investigation and your reading and your work after listening.
You mentioned a bit about kind of the response or at least the community building that has happened since the podcast has aired. Can you tell us, you also mentioned that the making of this has been a really kind of personal experience. Can you tell us a bit about the response of the podcast so far from people and what you both take away from the response and what you leave behind?
Great question. Well, the response has been incredible, more than we could ever have imagined. We haven't even been out for 5 months, and we've had in the vicinity of 75,000 downloads, which to us is what? what is that? And so we're just bowled over by the response. And I would say about 90 to 95% of that has just been overwhelmingly positive. And then of course there's always going to be some negative reaction or dissent to these personal stories. And like that was expected from the get-go. So I actually think like on balance, I think what we expected was like it to be the other way around, like negative. And it ended up being like so positive that we're just so happy about it. I think the takeaway that I have from it, or I think even both of us have from this takeaway, is that like people are really ready for these conversations. You said it yourself, like, yeah, you were like so excited and you were just ready for it. Like the issues of that we're talking about have just reached a boiling point in this industry. Like the industry has become large enough that the issues affect so many people in far-reaching places. And I just think that we are just so ready for it. And like representation matters, right? So like as an industry, we are craving more representation and more points of view. And like to the point that studios and teachers are realizing, like looking around and saying like, wow, the room is full of white people. That doesn't seem right. Like even in a diverse city like New York City, we go into a yoga classroom and it's all white. And then you walk out into the street and it's not all white. So it's like there's a disconnect. And people are asking us how to change this. So I think for us, like we're on the forefront of something was going to happen, a movement that was going to happen regardless. We just happened to be, you know, at the right place at the right time and be ready within ourselves to speak out and have the confidence to finally speak up about our experiences.
Okay. So the theme of Dragon Roots episode today that we're working on is broadly on the topic of wellness. The word wellness can sometimes bring up a lot of different connotations for people. What's your understanding of wellness compared to maybe the images and messages we get about that word?
Well, I'll just say, like, for me, the images I get are so completely different than what I really think about it. So like when I think of wellness, I think of this like something really elite. Something you have to like buy, something you have to like subscribe to, become a member of, or like completely adopt. Like, you know, you think of like those pictures of like sweaty, muscled up, skimpily dressed people doing like, you know, crazy workouts and like fad diets and having it all and not having any real stress in their life. And to me, that feels like really unrelatable and unattainable, and like this image of perfection that you can't really get to, versus like the way I really see wellness in my work and in my life is like people who are just tired trying to figure out how to live a better life. And so it's really about the day-to-day nitty-gritty and how can we operate better in this like kind of unnatural, weird circumstances that as humans we've created for ourselves. Like we're constantly looking at screens. We're so disconnected from each other in our community and our physical surroundings. And, you know, how can we navigate this in a new way to make us actually feel more connected and more at ease and not as stressed out and not as overwhelmed by the surroundings that we're in?
Yeah. So for the podcast, what are you hoping people walk away with when they listen to it? What do you hope they get out of it?
Well, one, we hope that they learn something from the podcast. And another is, depending on who you are, we hope that you feel really seen and heard through our version of storytelling and research and whatever issues we bring up. And we've kind of experienced that is the case for a lot of people. We also want people to just open their eyes and perk up and listen before jumping out and taking action and accusing other people of doing anything like what we've experienced. So we hope that people are sitting with the information first and foremost, and then adopting it for themselves before then like accusing others, right? And then the other, like there's a couple other things we want people to do in terms of taking that information and sitting with it. We hope that people start to understand this phrase we use often about living your yoga. And we describe it as a way to not just confine yoga to a space or a practice that you do for 60 minutes. That it's actually a way to live your life and continue asking questions of yourself, continue learning about the history and cultural context of yoga if you practice or teach it, and how to engage with more diverse communities as it affects everyone around you and not just you as an individual. Another major thing we want people to do is understand how to decolonize your wellness practice and space and the way you learn about yoga. So that's such an interesting idea. And it might even be like a catchphrase, decolonize your practice or decolonize your mind. But it's actually thinking about the way you invest your time and money and whether or not it participates in creating imbalanced hierarchies of power. Who are the people in power? We see this like in academia. Over 50% of professors are white men. And then they direct the narrative of how we learn information. And this is such an interesting thought exercise. Like when you think about your formal education, can you remember when you had a teacher of color? Can you remember when the books you referenced for your history and your study was written by someone who wasn't, you know, a white person, even when the topic wasn't about white people? So in the yoga world, in the wellness world, we offer suggestions about partnering and learning from people of color, and also taking the time to move out of your safe or comfortable spaces to enter into spaces that are more diverse and more engaging in terms of community and perspective.
Yeah, wow. Amazing. So thank you so much for coming on our show today and chatting with us and taking the time out of your day to do that. I guess just to wrap up, what can people expect from upcoming episodes? Where can they listen? All the deets.
So the upcoming episodes will be released soon. we're still working out the timeline on that, but they're going to focus more on diet culture and body image on one of the episodes, and the other episode will be about the process business, education standards and guidelines around becoming a yoga teacher. So what that looks like and, you know, what we feel about that. Did you ask where people can reach us? Is that what you said?
Yeah, where people can reach you or find you online, like the website and stuff.
Okay, great. So we have an Instagram handle, which is @YogaIsDeadPodcast, and a Facebook page, which is just Facebook/YogaIsDeadPodcast. You can email us at yogaisdeadpodcast@gmail.com. The only thing that's really different with our social media is the Twitter handle is YogaIsDeadPod, since we didn't have enough character space for the whole thing. And then we have a number of ways in which you can support us if you'd like. And so we do recurring donations or subscriptions through our Patreon page, where patrons get special benefits. And we like mail out like fun little gifts. And so that's and you can join for as little as $2 a month for that. And it's patreon.com/yogaisdeadpodcast. You could make a Venmo donation also @yogaisdeadpodcast. And then we have a number of things on our website, including you can make a donation on our website. You can shop, buy some swag. You can find all of our resources listed, all the interviews we've done, and much, much more. And the website is www.yogaisdeadpodcast.com.
You are listening to Dragon Root Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. That was our interview with the woman behind Yoga is Dead, a podcast on power, privilege, race, and appropriation in the wellness industry.
Lately, it seems that's just another word for keeping quiet.
You're listening to Dragon Root Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We're going to switch gears and present our interview with Dawn Canada. We had the chance to speak with Nelly from Dawn. Dawn is the Disabled Women's Network of Canada, and they recently released a report called Girls Without Barriers, an intersectional feminist analysis of girls and young women with disabilities in Canada. Here to talk more about Dawn and the report is Nelly.
My name is Nelly Basili, and I am I've been working with Dawn Canada for little over 2.5 years now. I'm the Director of Youth Initiatives and International Relations. Dawn Canada, so the Disabled Women's Network of Canada, or Dawn for short, is a feminist and cross-disability rights organization. So we have been defending the rights of girls and young women with disabilities for 35 years now. And Dawn Canada is explicitly a feminist organization that works in the disability sector, but we also bridge the gaps between the disability sector that may not have a gender lens and the feminist sector that may not have a disability lens. And how we do that and what that means is we do that through education, we do that through research, we do that through, partnering with organizations and helping them with their programs. We do that through advocacy and policy at more, I guess, higher levels, at governmental levels, but also advocacy with other organizations in various sectors.
Now, you touched on this a little bit, but what are Dawn's key principles, and what lens does Dawn examine inequalities and discrimination?
Yeah, sure. So obviously, we have the prism of looking at things through an intersectional feminist lens. And what that means is that we want to center the most marginalized in all of the work that we do. Not only center the most marginalized, but also add a disability in it, specifically a cross-disability lens. So if we break that down from an intersectional feminist perspective, we really want to center those who are from, you know, communities that have been historically marginalized. So that means Black, Indigenous, and people of color. When we add the cross-disability lens, we also look at, disability from a wide spectrum, and that means any form of disability, and not in a medicalized way, and giving people the agency, women the agency to self-identify, and not requiring any formal diagnoses. And moving away from the medical model and medical systems that, you know, have often been very detrimental and traumatic for girls and young women with disabilities and for people in general with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you tell us about the Girls Without Barriers project?
Sure. So Girls Without Barriers as a project is... has been running for a few years now, and the aim of Girls Without Barriers really is to work with organizations that are what we call girl-serving organizations that run programs for girls and really help them in the process of making their programming for girls more inclusive and respectful of the realities of girls with disabilities. And what that means is we look at things from a structural level. We look at things from how ableism affects, you know, what kind of programming, what kind of services are offered. And what we find is that if we look at it from a structural level, we work with organizations to also look at, you know, who is on their boards, who is on their staff. Do they, understand how ableism works within those structures as well, so that they are then better able to do their programming with girls with disabilities. So we really want to look at things from root causes, from structural levels, in order to help the programming be better and more inclusive for girls with disabilities. And we've been working with different organizations. For example, we've worked with Rock Camp for girls. Mm-hmm. We've also worked with Black Girls Summer Workshop, which are both camps for girls in the summertime, and they run programs for girls, and they're really wonderful programs and partners, because they really want to look at things from an intersectional feminist lens. They really want to look at things from a disability lens and better understand how they can, you know, get at things like ableism and explain it to kids, and be more inclusive of the different needs of girls with disabilities who may want to be part of their programs. And we really encourage them to do all of these things, you know, by helping them from recruitment to all the way to programming that they do. And within that, Girls Without Barriers, we also have a research component. And this is where our research report, you know, Girls Without Barriers, an intersectional feminist lens, you know, that looks at the situation of girls and young women with disabilities in Canada, also comes about. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a bit more about this, the research component, and if or what were some challenges that you encountered while conducting the study?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Girls Without Barriers, as a research project, the research component of this project came about because, you know, we actually a year ago released a report, another report called More Than a Footnote. And in that report, we already, you know, had the data that confirmed that women with disabilities are among the most marginalized in Canadian society. And what that means is they, you know, face multiple societal barriers to accessing things like education, employment, health, reproductive rights, and are also more at risk of experiencing things like gender-based violence. But what that research also showed is the lack of data about girls with disabilities. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Girls Without Barriers is really, as a research project, is really a first step in starting to bridge that gap. So over the course of this research, we found it difficult to access Canadian statistics about girls with disabilities. So, you know, Girls Without Barriers, as a research report, really set out to not only review literature that already exists in the form of, you know, academic articles and community/activist-based reports on the rights of girls and young women with disabilities, but it also intentionally set out to better understand the realities of girls with disabilities who not only have to deal with ableism as a system, but also racism, colonialism, sexism, heterosexism, and other systems of oppression, and how they intersect and affect their lives. You know, I also want to clarify that this report, you know, is a first step. It's not an exhaustive analytical work. We consider this report as a first exploratory research project that really did look at the existing literature as a first step towards the development of, you know, more qualitative studies carried out by and for young women with disabilities. We really, there is a dearth of information that directly talks from the perspective of girls with disabilities. So another thing that we mention and highlight in this report is we really need to move away from this adult perspective on girls. This adult perspective over time, it reinforces this infantilization of girls, and we're really trying to move away from that. And so, you know, we strongly urge everyone to listen to girls, to listen to their perspectives. Girls with disabilities have so much to bring about, and yet their perspectives are not sufficiently put out there without that lens, you know, that is an adult lens, because even the research that we looked at is from an adult perspective. The starting points are always from the adult perspective. So we're really trying to bring that to the fore and move away from that.
Hmm. In the report, you also take time to examine the increasing incarceration of girls and young women with disabilities. And you also emphasize that incarceration isn't limited to the imprisonment of people following court decisions. Can you talk to us a little bit more about how the erasure of this issue?
Sure. So maybe to start with, I can talk about what we mean by sort of our definition of incarceration, if you will. Mm-hmm. We, you know, as we are in an ableist society, disability is intrinsically linked with incarceration. And within, you know, the analyses that we work with at Dawn, we consider that incarceration is not limited to imprisonment of people following court decisions only, you know, so we broaden that definition of incarceration to include things like placement of people, consenting or not, or otherwise, into institutions that really limit their human rights, mm-hmm. that limit their living conditions and their dignity. You know, we have to remember that historically, Western societies included people, excluded, people with disabilities from the public sphere by limiting their access and, you know, or placing them in institutions. And so it is from that perspective that we look at incarceration. But more specifically, you know, we live also in a racist and colonialist society, and incarceration, in this case, via court decision, has a singular impact on racialized women, on Indigenous women. So just to clarify what we mean by that. Now, the way we looked at incarceration as well is how does it affect, for example, children when we talk about things like, and girls specifically, when we talk about things like school to prison pipelines, and how girls with disabilities who are racialized, so, you know, coming from racialized communities, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, are more affected by this, especially racialized girls with disabilities. The other thing that we looked at is how incarceration linked with migratory status affects girls with disabilities. And what we found is that the rate of, there was a report by the Canadian Council for Refugees that found in 2018-2019 that 118 children were detained in immigration detention. And the findings with that all indicate that the conditions of incarceration really are detrimental to the development of children. You know, they affect their mental health, they affect things like increasing anxiety and depression in children who have been through these detention conditions. And so it goes against human rights and protocols internationally that Canada has signed on to.
Were there any surprises that came up in the study, or was there, or I guess, and is there anything in the study that you feel everyone should know or take away?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that what we focalize on is, again, the lack of data that is available on girls with disabilities. The statistical data that is compiled does not look at the intersections of race and gender for girls with disabilities. And that is a huge lack that needs to be gapped. And that means, you know, having things like governments at the, you know, Canadian government at the federal level do a better job of collecting these kinds of data because they're important. Not collecting this data further invisibilizes girls and young women with disabilities. As it pertains to, you know, findings in the report that I think are really important to note, we note that girls and young women with disabilities face obstacles in accessing inclusive and empowering sex education. Given the various data that we've collected in the report, we also know that girls and young women with disabilities facing different systems of oppression are at higher risk of having their reproductive rights hampered and of being sterilized without consent. The literature also specifically addressing two-spirit, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, intersex, asexual, aromantic, pansexual, and more young people with disabilities, you know, calls out, among other things, the imposition of gender norms and sexual identities. So that means, that gender and sexual and physical norms imposed by an ableist society also have major consequences on the self-esteem of girls and young women with disabilities. And when we talk about, you know, things like body image, the research shows that the negative effects of beauty standards that are set, again, by an ableist and sexist society. The participation of girls and young women with disabilities in things like leisure and sports activities have significant positive impacts on their self-esteem. But the report shows that despite the importance of their participation in these activities, girls and young women with disabilities, you know, still remain underrepresented. Accessibility is still a major barrier. And, from our collaborations to make programs for girls more inclusive, what I talked about earlier with the Girls Without Barriers project, shows us that there's a tremendous amount of work that still remains to be done in creating more awareness about ableism and how it functions in order to better serve, you know, the needs of girls and young women with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that work that needs to be done, the report has recommendations and calls for action. Can you speak a bit to that?
Yeah, sure. So, the report, we have recommendations for government, for advocacy groups, and for human rights organizations in Canada to, you know, take action to ensure, you know, that girls are again, at the center of our concerns, especially when it comes to disability. So we have a lot of recommendations, but just to name a few. So for governments, you know, we want government to collect data on girls in Canada using an intersectional feminist and cross-disability analysis and make that data publicly available. We want government to consult girls with disabilities and guarantee their self-representation in decision-making spheres and in research, which they are, you know, the first concern. When it comes to education, we want government to make teaching establishments universally accessible. It is unacceptable that in Canada in 2020, there are still inaccessible establishments for education that limit the education of girls with disabilities. We also are asking for the development of national awareness and training programs for teachers and students to educate them about the various systems of oppression that I've mentioned, including, you know, a better understanding of what ableism means. When it comes to, sexuality and gender identity, we want governments to develop and standardize positive, inclusive, emancipatory sex education in Canada that really moves away from, you know, the adult perspective I mentioned earlier, in order to center the experiences and realities of girls and young women with disabilities. And that goes hand in hand with, you know, to subsidize the development of educational materials for parents, for health and school professionals, on the sexuality and reproductive rights of girls and young women with disabilities, and the list goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, what impact do you hope that this report has more broadly?
Yeah, well, we really would love that people better understand the realities of girls with disabilities who are most marginalized. We deliberately took an intersectional feminist lens in talking about this report. So we want people to have better knowledge of this report, read it, and understand that when we talk about girls with disabilities, they're not a homogenous group. Mm-hmm. Girls with disabilities, come with a complexity of identities and of systems of oppression that affect them. So when we did this report, we also illustrated the report, and we worked with an artist who is themselves a queer Black person with a disability to embody, what it means to have representation of girls with disabilities. The images we see in our report are not images that we see in mainstream media, and that needs to change, because in order to affect, all these things like self-esteem and that girls with disabilities feel like they matter and are empowered, they need to see themselves represented in those images that we see in the media. So we want to start to change the culture and shift, those ableist ideas of who young women with disabilities and girls with disabilities are, but also have them at the center of the decisions that will affect their lives.
Nelly, thanks so much for your articulate and enlightening answers. If people want to learn more or get involved, where can they go?
Sure. So in order to read our report, you will find it on the Dawn Canada website, and that's at www.dawncanada.net. I also encourage folks to go and follow us on social media. So if you go to Facebook, for example, and you type Disabled Women's Network, Réseau d'Action des Femmes Handicapées Canada, you will find us and you give us a like, and keep following the information that we put out there as it pertains to girls and young women with disabilities.
Perfect. Thanks so much again for chatting with us today.
You're listening to Dragon Root Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I'd like to thank all our guests who came on the show today. And be sure to tune in 2 Mondays from now for more reports on gender-based issues.
You're a silent forest, you're a wild flower. You've been moving backwards into the wildfire, but you're a sharpened arrow, spearing hearts stone cold, and you're a red-winged blackbird perched up on the wind. The darkest of wars. He never gave you time or the space to soar, but you're a sharpened arrow that tried to spear a heart stone cold, and you're a red-winged blackbird perched up on the window. Fly, carried
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends in private homes and yards are prohibited. Travel between regions should be avoided, and traveling to yellow zones is forbidden. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the other measures in place. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
As part of the 37th Festival International de Musique Actuelle de Victoriaville, CKUT 90.3 is proud to collaborate with CHYZ 94.3 for the presentation of Temayuge and This Quiet Army with Away, double bill concert on Saturday, May 22nd at 7:30 p.m. For a safe event of live living arts, let's meet in Victo next May. For all the details on the 37th edition of Festival International de Musique Actuelle de Victoriaville, visit fimav.qc.ca.
CKUT is hiring a spoken word coordinator. Do you have a passion for storytelling and amplifying perspectives outside of the mainstream media landscape? Are you interested in working at a collectively run, independent community radio station? CKUT's Spoken Word Coordinator is a full-time position starting June 1st that is responsible for the coordination of all CKUT's spoken word programming and is part of CKUT's Collective Management Committee. The position is 35 hours a week, pays $18.36 an hour, and applications will be accepted until